You're listening to Investigation Insiders by Integris Intelligence.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Investigation Insiders. This is Farhad. I hope you are all well and safe. We're actually recording this episode on the Monday before Thanksgiving. So I wanted to quickly take this opportunity to thank everyone for your support of both our show and our company. We could not be where we are today without you all. So thank you all very much. I'm happy to say we have another amazing guest today, John DeVito, the special agent in charge of the ATF here in New York. Thanks for joining us today, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, buddy. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. So John and I actually met through our mutual friend and industry superstar, Rich Kendall. Thanks again, Rich, for the connection. John, I guess what I was hoping we could start with for those that do not know you in our audience is just a broad overview of yourself.
Well, nothing really spectacular. I was born and raised in a small town in Anniston, Alabama, by a single Southern mother. From there, I moved to Northern Virginia and attended high school and college in that area. I went to a small military school called Virginia Military Institute, as well as James Madison University, both located there in the Virginia area. Upon graduation from college, I immediately began working for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and I've been there for the last 27 years. I have a wife and two daughters, 12-year-old twins. They pretty much take up all the rest of my time when I'm not here at work.
Well, you know what? I just learned two things about you that we have in common. First, we were both raised by women. My dad passed away, unfortunately, when we were pretty young, and my mother raised us until she passed away not too long ago. And we both have a set of twins. I have boys and you have girls. So just interesting kind of learning more about that.
Which are easier?
What's that?
Which are easier, boys or girls?
Well, you know what? I have four boys. I from what I hear, boys seem to be a little bit easier, but that's all based on the individuals, I guess.
Absolutely. They're well worth it, though, both boys and girls. So
Definitely. So the ATF, right? It's a smaller agency and not as well known as the FBI and Secret Service and everyone else. Can you give our audience an overview of the organization and what its overall mission is?
Basically, you know, ATF was derived from a tax agency. You know, they're originally part of the IRS, created back during the gangster days. And our job was to, you know, regulate the alcohol and tobacco industries at first, because there's a great deal of taxes that are imposed on those type of vice things. And as the prevalence of the violence within the gangster community became more prevalent, we became, you know, taken over the 1934 National Firearms Act, which is, those are like the short sawed-off shotguns, machine guns, and such. And as the agency continued to progress in 1972, we became a standalone agency, same year as DEA was actually founded. And our job right now is to enforce the federal firearms, arson, and explosives laws here in the United States. We also are duly responsible for regulating the firearms and explosive industry here in America. So in addition to our criminal investigators who go out there every single day and, you know, risk their lives to try to prevent gun violence and the trafficking of firearms to the criminal element, we also have industry operations investigators who go out there and work with our industry partners to make sure that our federal firearms licensees, as well as explosives licensees, are abiding by ATF rules and United States rules and regulations in accordance with those industries. So we're very, very unique in that capacity.
Yeah, I mean, especially considering some of the discussions around weapons here in the U.S. But you already mentioned where you grew up. How'd you end up like joining the ATF? Is there a story behind that, or is that a pretty
Well,
just
it's actually kind of a sad story. February 8th, 1990, I lost my mother during a violent gun interaction with an individual, and she was shot and killed. During that same instance, I myself was shot multiple times, and that was in 1990 in a small town in Alabama, of course, where I've already said I grew up. And from that point forward, I sort of kind of just decided that I was going to do something with my life. By 1995, I'd already graduated high school. I was in college, and I was performing an internship for ATF because I decided that's the agency I was going to work for. And I've been there ever since. So this is, I tell people all the time that, for the past 33 years, all I've known is gun violence.
Wow. I'll tell you what, of all the stories I've heard in terms of how people ended up where they ended up, that has to be one of the most like closest to home. So, I'm sorry to hear that about your mom. I'm sorry that obviously you were shot as well, but in a way the world has benefited through your good work with the ATF. So thank you for that. I guess like many other agencies consider New York to be like the prominent or the most prominent office. I'm not sure if that's true with the ATF. And how does it feel to be like, especially if you're from a small town, you still live in a somewhat small town. So, but to be the SAC of the agency here in New York.
Well, to address the first part of the question, we have divisions all across this country that are doing great work and have dedicated professionals that, again, that are risking it all to, make their community safer. So I would never ever say that one office is more prominent than the other. There are definitely bigger divisions in ATF with more personnel than there are in New York. Our border states, we dump a lot of resources down there because of the risks to those communities by the cartels and stuff like that. New York is a medium-sized office, but I think it's got a much larger footprint when it comes to the political angle. And as someone told me when I first got assigned here, that anything that happens in New York automatically becomes national news simply because of the media market in this area. So they definitely wanted to make me aware of that, and to mind my P's and Q's and make sure that we were running the office in a professional manner, because at the end of the day, anything that happens here is going to be broadcast out, loud and clear. I will say that, my director has told me specifically that, New York, LA are pretty much the kind of the offices that he keeps an eye on the most, because again, the politics that occur here, the interactions with our peers and the media market, anything that happens could either be good or bad. So he's always very cognizant of what's going on in New York and LA. How's it feel for me? I mean, again, I grew up in a small town in Anniston, Alabama. I was the epitome of white trash. My mother was poor. She'd always been poor, and she was going to remain poor. We lived in Section 8 housing in the Norwood Projects for a time. So now, seeing how my life has progressed, and here I am at the pinnacle of my career, basically representing ATF in this, with all my peers and partners from, the FBI is just phenomenal in this city. DEA, I believe they have the largest offices in the nation for both their agencies. So it makes me feel very, very proud. It's also kind of intimidating, but I learned long ago that if you act like you're intimidated, then people will try to intimidate you. So I try to do my very best to bring my game up to the level of my peers. And every single day I go to work trying to do better than I did the previous day, because it is a responsibility to serve as the SAC in New York here, and work with the men and women of ATF that have been here for many years, and to be an outsider into that political game. But I've heard that throughout my entire career. When I first got assigned to, when I went from my street time as an agent in Miami, where I spent about 16 years working with some phenomenal investigators and working some great cases. And then I got reassigned to Washington, D.C. And, the first thing all the the street agents tell you, say, hey, it's different here than what you're used to. And then when I got reassigned to New York and New Jersey, and what I've found is that the politics are all the same, bad guys are all the same, and we're doing the exact same job here that we were doing in Miami. We're trying to dedicate our time more effectively to better address the violent gun crime that's plaguing our cities.
Sure. No, that's very helpful. So you actually sort of alluded to being better today than yesterday. And so I guess when you got here, and I guess you probably thought about what do I want to accomplish here? And so just curious as to what your goals were, and have you all as a team been able to get to some of those goals and accomplish them?
Yeah, absolutely. So first and foremost, I had a very, very clear game plan when I arrived in New York City. And that was 100% to become better partners with NYPD. Here we have NYPD, the largest police force in the entire nation, the well-funded professional staff. They've got every tool under the sun to help protect the public. But what I knew is that we had tools at ATF that were being underutilized. Such as the tracing program, which allows us to track the first manufacturer, first sale of a firearm to which recovered in a crime, as well as our National Integrated Ballistic Information Network, which allows us to basically tell the crime gun story of that specific firearm. So I knew I wanted to make sure that NYPD and ATF were the best partners when it came to utilizing all the crime gun intelligence that is being generated on a daily basis by the criminal elements here in New York. So I wanted to ensure that those two tool sets were optimized to the nth degree. So that was the plan of action that I set forth for myself when I first arrived. In addition to that, I knew that once we had NYPD exploiting those tools, everybody else would come into the fold, FBI, DEA, as well as all of our other state and local partners, to include the state police, because they would see the benefits of exploiting that information in real time and working together in a collaborative manner to, again, better protect the public. The more we know about crime guns, the better we are to prevent the crimes they're used in. And that was a moniker that I tried to just, espouse every single time I had a meeting with any of my state and local partners. And I was sort of a bull in the china shop. I had been in this game for a long time. Violent crime is my arena. So I specifically, would call out partners and say, hey, look, we're not doing this right. We need to change things here and there. And I decided, since this was what I expected to be my last stop in federal law enforcement, that I was going to pull out all the stops and basically just break down walls and break down silos of intelligence, which have existed for many, many years in the gun violence realm.
That's amazing that again you initiated that and feel like you've made a dent in it. So that's fantastic. And I mean, obviously from a very practical perspective, that has impact on everybody's lives, New Yorkers and otherwise. So that's fantastic. So what are the things that stick out in your mind about your time in general with the ATF?
Again, having the opportunity to work with some of the finest investigators on some of the biggest cases that this country has seen. I remember being a street agent working a case, and I was actually in the grand jury room interviewing a witness with Michael Brown, who was a assistant United States attorney, who's now a federal judge, when the first plane hit, and us pulling in a TV and watching those attacks that terrorized our country. And I remember the next day being assigned to the FBI Miami Field Division to assist with the 9/11 investigation about tracking the movements of these suspects prior to the attacks. And I remember thinking what a monumental moment this was in our American history, and how I was playing a small role, but hopefully significant. Then I remember getting the call that I was being sent to DC as a street agent in Miami because of the DC sniper attacks, and being assigned an investigative team in Southern Virginia, basically trying to track these movements, and being one of the first teams at the steakhouse when we found the note. And then again, as my career progressed, being the assistant special agent in charge of the Washington Field Division, I receive a phone call from one of my street agents saying, hey, and something just happened at the softball field. I happen to live about six blocks from the softball field where Congressman Scalise was shot.
Sure.
And us arriving on the scene, you know, at first thing in the morning, thinking this was nothing, and then realizing, oh no, this was actually, you know, a domestic terrorism event, and waiting for our FBI counterparts to arrive and being good partners with them and providing them whatever intel we could on the suspect and the firearm, just working hand in hand with them. You know, and then as, you know, as recently as April 12, 2022, when Frank James, you know, terrorized the city and fired over 32 rounds on a crowded subway car. I remember being down there about 8:30 in the morning, walking the subway terminal, you know, seeing that devastation that this individual perpetuated on the citizens of New York. And again, knowing that the men and women of ATF with our partnership with NYPD basically took this crime gun intelligence from the firearm itself, tracked the life cycle of that gun, which encompassed 15 years, five different states. And then about 9 o'clock that night, calling my peers over at NYPD saying, we got him. We got him. We put the gun in his hand. And that changed it from a suspect to we have a defendant now. That was a powerful moment for us. And it really showcased all the tools that we had built the previous 3 years to show that efficiency that we had put in place here in New York City, that we took this random gun, you know, found at the scene of the crime, and then tracked it across this country over a span of 15 years and actually had able to come back and say, this intelligence works if we use it, but it has to be optimized to the nth degree so that it provides meaningful intelligence for us. And so it was almost like it showcased all this hard work that went into it. And then here we are seeing the fruits of our labor.
That's amazing. And, you know, I can't help but, again, come a little bit full circle on you talking about your mom and how you lost her and, you know, kind of what she meant to you, to the work that you've done and the accomplishments you've had. So I'm sure she would be very, well, she is very proud to know about everything that you're doing. So really kind of neat to see it all come into sort of play. So as we discussed, our show is called like Investigation Insiders. And what we try to do is peel back the layers on the topics of discussion that and offer our listeners a behind the scenes look. So that sort of brings us to the topic of our show. How does the work you all do at the ATF impact the safety and security of people and companies in the US? So just want to go through a series of questions. From your perspective as the SAC of the New York office, what are the biggest safety and security concerns or threats to US companies and its citizens?
Well, first and foremost, and again, this is that thing I kind of alluded to early on, I think, before the podcast started. You know, violent gun crime is the number one issue that impacts our society here in America. It doesn't get the narrative that, say, terrorism does, drug overdoses. But when you consider the fact that 48,830 people were killed in 2021, you know, I think 2022 is up. 48,217. And 2021, by the way, was the most violent year in American history. If we want to look at stats, you know, there's been 1.2 million people killed in all American wars since the Revolutionary Wars. 1.2 million, phenomenal figure. There's been 1.5 million people killed by gun violence in the last 50 years. Okay, gun violence is the number one issue that's affecting our economy, our world, our communities, everything. And yet we do not have a unified strategy to address it here in the U.S. People don't realize the number of guns that are already out there. And we have an estimate of about 475 million. But even that, we don't know if that's an accurate accounting because less than 30% of the firearms manufacturers actually provide the data that they're supposed to.
Right.
And that number is ever changing. And then you got another 16 million added to the economy every single year, just in new guns made, another 6 million imported every single year. So the number of guns out there in this country are staggering. And ATF does not have an issue with firearms ownership. Our job is simply to prevent firearms ending up in the hands of criminals who are going to utilize that to terrorize our communities. And when the shootings are going up considerably every single year, you know, 4,000 people have been killed by mass shootings in the last 8 years. Right. How many more school shootings do we have before we start working, working together and collaborating on, in a real-time manner on a consistent basis to better address these threats? Because we've looked at this as a battle of attrition. We're simply going to arrest our way out of this problem. And mm-hmm. my philosophy and ATF's philosophy is that, no, what we've got to do is take our minimal resources, our limited resources, and more effectively apply them to the problem. So what that means to me and ATF and my, you know, work with my partners is, let's utilize all this intelligence that we have at our disposal. So I want to take the intelligence from FBI, DEA, my state and local partners, and overlay that with everything ATF knows about the crime guns. And let's find that small percentage of the criminal element, that 1%. These are the trigger pullers. These are the people out there in the community every single day that are mm-hmm. pulling the trigger and terrorizing these communities. And then let's figure out, if while we're simultaneously figuring out who the trigger puller is, let's figure out who the traffickers are who are providing the means by which those individuals can wage war in our communities. Yeah. So if we simultaneously attack the trafficking and the trigger pullers, we're going to have a much larger impact on the violent crime problem that's affecting our country. So as far as your, you know, the companies and everything like that participate and listen to your podcast, I would tell them to, one, invest in their communities around them, because your workforce needs to feel safe where they're going every single day to perform their duties. Mm. And we simply don't do enough of that in this country, in my opinion. You know, I said the other day with the governor that, you know, I've said this a long time, is that, hey, look, we need a whole of government approach to addressing gun violence. That means federal, state, and local law enforcement working hand in hand together. But as I continue to grow and learn more about this, this mission, is no, we need a whole of New York approach to this. I want my community leaders, my faith leaders, the business leaders in those communities working hand in hand to address problems that law enforcement can't. Law enforcement has a set of tools that we can deploy to address the problem. But at a certain point, if the problem doesn't, you know, solicit those type of reactions, law enforcement is kind of, you know, hamstrung. But if the community and the faith leaders can then bridge that gap, now we have a whole of New York philosophy when it comes to addressing gun violence. So for those business leaders out there, I would wholeheartedly suggest that you reinvest in your communities that surround your employees, because a safe and happy community are going to turn around and be better employees for you. So it's reinvesting in your communities.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really great point. I guess you talked about a lot there, right? In terms of there's a lot. We could probably have a single show on five things that you just said right there. But, you know, when you look at the effect of, let's just say a company and, you know, investing in the community, when you're trying to assess the effectiveness of what they're doing, how do you do that? How do you assess what you're doing currently, what more you could be doing, and, you know, what the impact of those things are? But what would you say to that?
I'm not a big fan of stats. I think statistical manipulation can, you know, alter the credibility of stats in a lot of ways. While, you know, it can be like a guide. My philosophy is to continually ask questions. And if I go to work every single day, which is kind of like how I address it with my staff, every day I go to work and I say, what can we do better? Hmm. What can we do different? And if we're constantly asking ourselves, rather than resting on what we did yesterday and the effectiveness, I think we continue to grow and evolve. So every single day, you know, hey, look, we formed a great partnership with this agency. Okay, who's next? Right. Okay, what more can we do with that agency? What did we discover about some of the tools that have been stuck in a closet, and how can we better deploy those and exploit them to do something different? So my thing is always ask what next?
Sure.
And what else should we be doing? You know, you're investing in the community. So like, we'll take the business question again. We're investing in the community. Okay, what are we doing to invest in our employees? Are we monitoring their mental health? Do we have some type of social engagement policy or practice where we can see if someone is reaching some type of critical mass? This actually just came up the other day. I got a call from a former colleague asking me to look into a former employee that was exhibiting certain signs. And I told my people, we've got to investigate this because we don't know what could happen. And so we have to act appropriately. But I think companies can do, you know, a lot of good things with ensuring the mental stability and health of their employees. And again, that's going to affect their bottom line because, you know, everybody deals with stress in different ways. So it's all looking internally and asking what more can we do?
Don't ever stop. Maybe my question rather than say, how do you assess the effectiveness? It's more so how do you assess if you're asking the right questions and are you doing it frequently enough? Because you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, what happens is like, you know, there might be an incident or something occurs and all of a sudden everybody is, you know, like very hot on the topic and doing a lot of things and then it disappears and so do all the questions, right? But I think what I'm hearing from you, which I agree with, is that process shouldn't start and stop. It should always be going on. And, you know, that's where some of the best information is gleaned and then decisions are made on those. Would you agree with that?
And I apologize if I didn't answer your question exactly how you phrased it, but
all good. Yeah.
You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly how I look at it is
yeah.
We're never perfect. We're never going to be perfect. And the moment we, you know, we initiate this program thinking that it's going to accomplish X, Y, and Z, and it does X, Y, and Z, and we go, okay, that's a winner. We're going to keep doing that. That's a successful program.
Yep.
No one's constantly within that in leadership going, okay, it's working. Where's it going to fail? What are we missing? What could we do more of? Or what should we be doing more of? Those questions have to be continuous. So, and let's make it's all relative too. So this program is succeeding, but yet three other ones are failing and something slips through the cracks and we lose somebody. And I tell people this every day is that, hey, look, I think I'm very good at my job. I'm always trying to push the envelope and I'm always asking what else, but people die every single day in this country. Kids die in this country every day. You know, a person dies pretty much every hour on the hour in this country.
Right.
And if I'm simply sitting back going, why I did these programs and they worked great, but people still died. Well, I fail at my job every single day. And I'm not happy about saying I fail every single day, but I do.
Yeah.
Because people continue to die and guns get trafficked into the hands of shooters and make that all possible. Well, that's a failure on my part. And that's a failure on law enforcement. So there are never good days. There simply aren't. So every single day I have to wake up and go, what more can I do with the resources I have, with the partnerships I have? Maybe I need to build more partnerships and force multiply. And if I can help a local law enforcement agency better optimize their tools, then we're getting better, but we're still never, you know, judging our effectiveness. We're simply going, did this work? What more should we be doing?
Yeah, and I think those are all great points, and I think in fact you answered the question better than I had hoped. So thank you. So maybe, you know, again going back to the fact that the ATF is not as well known of an agency, I think people are always concerned about how do I stay on top of the threats? How do I learn about information? How do I get information that might be available out there that I don't even know about? So can you talk a little bit about what the ATF offers to private companies and, you know, citizens as far as information and where they could get information, how to address concerns, really?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, ATF is a public facing agency. So we publish a great deal of intelligence on our outward facing website that's readily available to anybody that has questions about what we do, what we have done, and what the overall landscape of America looks like when it comes to gun violence. So that's readily available to everybody. Participating in things like InfraGuard here in New York, I think it's something I learned about when I first got here. Working hand in hand with industry and law enforcement, and kind of merging those two groups, kind of encompasses that philosophy that I have. A whole of New York strategy to addressing gun violence. I'd like to see ATF more involved in that, and I'm working every single day to be more a part of it and to broadcast out to the public, what the real threat to Americans are. Which is gun violence. So that is a dilemma that I face on a daily basis. I deploy one of the best public information officers here in New York, Amanda Hay, a former Marine who goes at this like a Marine, and she's out there every single day trying to put me in front of people so that I can answer these questions that they might have. We gave a great presentation the other night at the Harvard Club with the YPO organization. And I go into every single one of those, like you just said. No one knows what ATF is. No one knows what ATF does. No one knows what the true threat is. And then I go in there and do my very best to educate them. And then when I tell them, when you walk out of here, I want you to utilize your power and influence within your area of responsibility to educate your peers. Again, get them involved in regenerating their communities that surround their businesses. Get more engaged with the violent crime problem that's plaguing our, our populations that, fall below the socioeconomic platform. These are all good things, and the only way you can accomplish that is by being educated on the issues. So this is probably one of the hardest things for law enforcement, especially federal law enforcement, to deal with, is kind of broadcasting out what we do, how we do it, and what the real threat is, because we're so focused 100% on stopping the criminal activities that we simply kind of forget over here is like, oh, simultaneous to this, I need to be talking about what we're doing. And I can't say too much because it's ongoing proceedings, there's intelligence that can't be broadcast out. It's a dilemma that we're doing our very best to try to overcome and to be more transparent, but at again, every day I go, what more could we be doing? Is there another group we can talk to? Can we set up a meeting with this group? Because I've told people I'll talk to anybody. We had a meeting with a producer from Law and Order the other day who wanted to know about gun violence. So we brought him in and we completely blew his mind on gun violence. And my thing was, I'm doing this because I'd like to see a show like Law and Order talk about the real issues and how law enforcement tries to tackle them.
You know
something
what?
that FBI is very good at. They're very good on their outward facing, public face to educate the community. I want to be more like FBI in that regard.
I'll tell you one thing that's interesting as I listen to you about this is, again, your focus on the community, your focus on the people, really. I mean, that's who you serve, right? You serve like the people, the community, to keep all of us safe and secure and out of harm's way and all that sort of stuff. I love the fact that you're talking about that. That's one of the interesting things about like our show. It started out as one thing and it's sort of morphed into other things. And I love getting folks like yourself out there talking. I mean, you're doing the work every day, right? This is not a secondhand account of what's going on. And the fact that you are, again, because like some of like stories like this, maybe for depending on what the platform is, may not be sensational enough. They may be considered boring, but this is the important stuff that I think needs to get out there so that people also realize that, you know what, law enforcement agents like yourself are really working on making things better and maybe not what people see on TV and other places. You know what I mean? So I appreciate you addressing all those sorts of things. So last question I have for you is there a story that just to stay on that like community theme and how important it is for you to not only safeguard the community, but how much you want to work with the community. Is there a story or an anecdote that comes to mind from the work you've done over the past, 20 plus years on with the ATF that just sticks out in your mind, like of a situation where it may have started as adversarial, but ended up as being, like a feel-good story.
Actually, I have the perfect one. I've told many people this, that when I first arrived in New York, again, my strategy was to become the best partner I could with NYPD. And working with that phenomenal organization and their rich culture and history is just astounding. And again, being, a poor white trash kid from Alabama, how could I possibly, how could I possibly impress these professionals? And I'll be honest with you, it was a tough go. Very early on, I was trying to explain my expertise in the gun violence realm, and my knowledge and prior experience running the NIBIN program and the trace and trafficking programs for ATF, and it did not go over very well with NYPD. And I basically walked away licking my wounds and basically saying I screwed this up. I got too cocky. But then again, I wake up the next day and go, okay, what next? And I continued working towards that. I continued building partnerships and, trying to bring people into my thought process and explain and justify why I was asking us to change things. And that process continued slowly but surely. And we, we won people over, I think. And we built this phenomenal partnership, especially with NYPD and HIDTA program here in New York City. And we merged our resources to create this intel apparatus. And then again, we say, what next? And then, I wanted to bring in the prosecutors to the fold because if all my investigators are sitting side by side discussing the violent crime issues, the prosecutors need to be simultaneously within that conversation. So having the ability to partner with NYPD and get all five district attorneys here in New York City to come to a Monday to a morning meeting every day at 10 a.m. and sit down and talk about the violent crime problem from the night before and figure out how we're going to utilize all of our collective resources and expertise and talent to better protect the public. To me, that was a monumental tasking because I've been told it never ever occurred. And if it did, it didn't last very long. And
Sure.
so in February of 2022, we sort of saw this all come to a head where this program, this partnership, this gun violence strategic partnership was underway and it was proving successful every single day because this prosecutor would not know about three shootings that occurred in another borough, and but they had direct correlation to a case that they were already working, and bringing that intel to the front and center of everybody, and then having them work out a strategy to more effectively prosecute, and apprehend and stop that violence was just amazing. So in February 2022, we get notification that, well, President Biden was going to come visit because he wanted to see what was going on in New York. So we held this, massive presentation at 1 PP, and there with the Mayor Adams, newly appointed Commissioner Kishant Sewell, and a bunch of U.S. senators. And so my purpose was that day was I was supposed to brief the president. And I remember prior to this event occurring, I was speaking with Attorney General Garland, and again, I have a very curt, in-your-face kind of approach. That's how I was as a street agent. That's how I've been as a SAC here in New York. Is I don't like sugarcoating things. I like being straightforward and blunt, and address the issue rather than talking around it. So I remember right before we were about to sit down, the Attorney General Garland walks up to me and says, "John, whatever you do, don't cuss at the president." And he said it. He's a lovely man. I have nothing but the greatest respect for him. He's been so kind to me. And I remember thinking to myself, he's joking with me, but he's not. And John, realize where you're sitting right now. And you can't be that white trash kid from Alabama right now. You've got to be professional. And to me, that was a surreal moment where it kind of took my breath away a little bit. And I went, okay, act the part. You've accomplished something good. The president's here. This is not the time to yell at the president to do more, which I want, which is exactly what I was planning on doing. I was going to say, hey, look, this is great, but we're failing all over over here. And that was
Right.
exactly my plan. And I literally, it was a very surreal moment, Rod. And I had
Sure.
to go, stop. Don't be the white trash kid today. Just let your peers and your partners and your subordinates bask in their glory of having the praise of the president on something that they've worked so hard to create. Because it wasn't me that created it. It was the men and women on the ground that put this entire infrastructure into place in this partnership. I
Right.
simply just came in with an idea. So to me,
Well,
that was kind of like the pinnacle of my career right there. And again, it was a surreal moment.
that's awesome. I appreciate you sharing that, and I really appreciate you participating in our show and talking about the things that you talked about. I'm hopeful, like each and every episode, that we, a few people, even if one person, two people, 10 people, whatever, walk away with a bit of information that will help them, stay safer, make better decisions, whatever the case is. We consider that a success. So thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you all for tuning in. Till next time, John, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Don't forget to follow us. We are on LinkedIn and Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube.